Welcome, everyone, to Country Joe's Chicken Show here at countryjoeschickenshow.com, where this show is one of our sponsors is Grow2Max at grow2max.com. And we have with us today, of course, Country Joe himself.
Right here.
That's Joe Barber. And while we say we are Country Joe's Chicken Show, we really, in all honesty, talk about every kind of poultry out there. And our first guest today we have is a gentleman here to talk about oscillated turkeys. Welcome to Country Joe's Chicken Show, Mr. McRoberts.
Thank you very much. It's fun to be able to share a little bit more about oscillated turkeys with everyone this afternoon.
And boy, no better person than me, because now I'm all fascinated on these things. I never knew they existed a month ago, and then until I got a hold of Christine Heinrich's book and saw that beautiful turkey in there, and I've been after her, and then that's how we got to you. So what can you tell us about these things? How do we get one? I've been going crazy.
Well, first, let's let him tell us about them before we get Joe to buy one.
Well, and I'm not going to be the one to offer too much insight on where exactly you can get one. I've spent the last 4 years, though, researching the bird down in their native habitat in Campeche, Mexico, on the Yucatan Peninsula. Uh-huh. And so the oscillated turkey shares the genus Meleagris with our wild turkey here in the United States. It's the only other species in that genus. And up until a few years ago, not much was known about the bird. There wasn't much published literature out there. Past explorers in Central America had described the bird in their travel journals for the last 200 years. But our research project that we started in 2010 is really the first of its kind to learn life history traits and ecological characteristics of the species.
Now, are they rare? Is this the only place they're found is right there in the Yucatan Peninsula, right, in the world?
They have a very restricted range in the wild. The only place they're found is the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, mainly the states of Campeche, where I've done my research, mm-hmm. and then Yucatan State and Quintana Roo. That's where Cancun is, so that's a familiar place to many of us. And then northern portions of Belize and Guatemala. And those are the only three countries you'll find the bird in its native range. And down there, the distribution is patchy. There are some places where birds used to be, but they've been harvested out by subsistence hunters or through some habitat changes, and they're not there like they used to be. But then there's other spots where there's very healthy population densities. I've seen groups in agriculture fields that number into the hundreds, and so it's not like they're a species on the brink of extinction or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And now, why are they so rare? Hard to get, I guess. So that's what I want to say.
Well, I think I'm not very attuned to the captive breeding programs or availability of them, but one of the characteristics of the species that's been described for decades is they're just a wary, finicky bird that doesn't respond well to handling, it can be challenging to keep in captivity. And so I know several zoos in the United States have been able to keep them, and I know that the Dallas World Aquarium has probably one of the largest captive populations. But I've heard anecdotally from bird breeders that they're a species that can just be challenging to keep in captivity.
That's what I heard.
Because we're on the radio here, I want to describe these birds to people before anybody figures out they're just turkeys. Why is Joe so fascinated with them? They are gorgeous birds. They have multicolored feathers. Do they all have that blue head?
Yes, males and females alike have that powder blue colored head with the red and orange nodules that almost people will call them warts. I think they deserve a little more credit than that. That's not exactly what they are, but they all have those colorful spots on their heads and then iridescent feathers of green, orange, blues, golds. And the photos that folks see do them justice, but it's even more amazing to see them in the feather with the sun reflecting off of those feathers, and it's a spectacular bird.
It sure is. And I was also hearing that they are hard to keep in, you know, breed in captivity, and maybe that's what makes them so rare, in captivity, I guess. But I've been looking, searching all over, and I really haven't come up with anybody that has them, other than zoos, I guess.
And I've heard of very few accounts, and so I wish I could direct you to the one-stop oscillated turkey shop, but I'm not sure if that exists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, how big are they compared to our normal, the wild turkeys in Northern America?
It's not exact, but it's pretty close to say they're about half the size. And so mm-hmm. an adult male would be, a big adult male would be 12 pounds. And I've weighed hundreds of turkeys, and it's rare to see one go over 12 pounds, but not unheard of. The females, about half the size of a female wild turkey. Some other morphological differences between the two species. They don't have a beard. The male doesn't have the beard like our wild turkey does.
Mm-hmm.
But it has long, sharp spurs. Spurs in excess of 2 inches aren't unheard of. And so there's some different physical characteristics between the species as well.
And that may be another reason why they're not very common in captivity. Those 2-inch spurs, if they're a wary bird, I think, Joe, you might end up bleeding.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've captured birds down in Campeche and put radios on them to track their movements and their mortality sources and some of that ecological data. And I can tell you from handling the birds, I've been cut more than once with those spurs when they'll kick a leg at you, and it can do some damage.
And, wow. and they, not only do they have them, they apparently know how to use them very well.
Now, when you were down there, they won't let you take them out of the country.
They're
right?
Always ready. Excuse me?
Yeah, you know, we are going to run out of time for this segment, and Joe always hates when I say this, but you're going to stick with us, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Excellent. Well, We, and Joe was hoping that you'd be able to say, of course, you can get an oscillated turkey, just go to this stop. And but there might be some bandages involved if you try to just go get one, Joe.
Yeah. Sounds it.
We'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show here on CountryJoesChickenShow.com. Back to Country Joe's Chicken Show, where we're actually talking turkey at the moment. Now, Mr. McRoberts, how did you decide to study these turkeys? I mean, they're gorgeous and everything, but how did you come across them in the first place?
It was one of those situations where the stars aligned and the opportunity was there. This oscillated turkey research project has actually been the focus of my PhD dissertation at Texas Tech University, where I'm working on a degree in wildlife science. And we had some collaborators come together, including the National Wild Turkey Federation, and recognized that not much was known about this species. And I was interested in working out of the country on some wildlife research. And that was back in 2009. And I arrived in Campeche in January 2010 with not a whole lot of Spanish capabilities, but that's our operating language down there now, and we just started chipping away at what we could learn about the bird, and that was several years ago.
Now, the deal is they won't let you, I mean, when I say you, they won't let people take them out of the country, you know, buy them and take them out legally? Is there a way to do that?
I've never heard of that being done. Mm-hmm. I know that's where the original stock of birds had to come from, just
right.
Because that's their only range. But I think that that'd be a difficult thing to accomplish this day and age.
Huh.
And are their eggs, because they're about half the size of our wild turkeys, are their eggs comparable in size, or?
They are comparable in size. And at birth, the chicks are comparable in size. And then just as the poults develop, they end up being not as big as the birds we face. And part of that could be the geographic differences between the two species. A more northern, there's a kind of a ecological principle that the farther you go toward the poles, the larger body size you get for any wildlife species. And so seeing that they're farther south and closer to the equator, they just might not be as big because of different environmental conditions.
Now, what is their food? Is their food different than regular turkeys, wild turkeys up here?
No, very similar. We actually just finished analyzing some food habit data from wild oscillated turkeys and found that most of their diet for adult birds consisted of seeds, and that insects were important to poult development, but that most of the adult diet was seeds, some grasses and flowers, fruits, native to that part of the world. But generally speaking, their diet is not much different than what we see with wild turkeys here in the mm-hmm. United States.
And what's their habitat like down there? Because, of course, I think of a lot of Mexico as very dry and deserty.
Well, the Yucatan is a real interesting ecosystem in itself. Its hottest and driest months are April and May, and then in June, the rainy season begins and will last through September, October, November, where that's tropical rains like you'd expect. And so their seasonality is different than what we see here, but it's more of a forested, some folks will refer to it as jungle environment, and then there's been some slash and burn agriculture practices in the jungle areas that have resulted in agricultural fields, and the turkeys seem to be attracted to those areas in addition to using the jungle habitats. So you might go out and look for oscillated turkeys on a bird watching trip and also see parrots and toucans and monkeys and jaguar tracks and boa constrictors. So it's very much a tropical environment in that part of Mexico.
Wow. Interesting, yeah. Interesting.
It's made research interesting when you're out there and know that there's all those kind of critters moving around with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. But the turkeys are the only one that Joe would probably try to sneak in under his jacket to take home. Is their breeding cycle a year round, or is it just wondering, because you said their hottest, driest months are in the spring. Does that skew when they lay and when they raise their chicks, or is that a year round process?
Well, it's similar to what we see, but it's a different mechanism driving it. And so they'll come out, they'll begin their reproductive displays, and the strutting and the reproductive behaviors exhibited by the males are amazing. Folks might be able to look around online and see some videos, but they make a vocalization that's similar to a gobble, but still quite different. And that'll begin in March and go through April and May. And then hens will start to nest just before that rainy season starts. And what I believe is driving that is those rains come after the dry months and there's an emergence of insect life that the poults need in their first 6 weeks of development. So it's timed more to the rains than it is the seasonal warming up that we see in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you still doing research on these turkeys, or is it pretty much over?
No, my last field season was in January through June 2013. So I'm over a year removed, and right now I'm more of a office wildlife biologist at the moment while I'm writing my dissertation and assimilating all these findings and results that have come from four field seasons down in Campeche. So I wish I was down there. That's the fun part. But right now it's the writing and data analyst and all that analysis that goes with this sort of work.
Yeah, that's it. The writing and the data analysis and all the documentation, that's the dry part of being a field researcher. It doesn't matter how much it's raining down there. Now, is there a website or someplace where if people were interested, they could find more information about them?
What I would recommend is the Cornell Ornithological Laboratory has a database called Neotropical Birds, and it's developing species profiles of all the bird life found in the neotropics. And there's a species account that I authored on the oscillated turkey that'll give summary of reproductive characteristics, conservation needs, pretty much everything we know about oscillated turkey to this point. And so all folks would need to look for is type in neotropical birds oscillated turkey into an online search engine, and they should get that Cornell website. And there's lots of photos on that species account as well, so people can get an idea of what this bird really does look like and how it's it kind of breaks the mold on what you'd think of a turkey would look like.
Yeah, it's way more exotic looking and colorful.
Wow.
And like, you know, I've had turkeys up here in Massachusetts hollering in my backyard on a spring morning, whereas I holler back and say, I'm not the right species female. Go look elsewhere. Now, you said the biggest probably captive population you know of is in Dallas.
That's what I've been told by some folks in the zoo industry, that the Dallas World Aquarium, which is, as I understand it, a private aquarium but operated to where the public can access it, and they've kind of developed the breeding program for captive oscillated turkeys. Now, most of this, I'm further removed from the captive side of it, and so folks would want to do a little research on their own before they went to the Dallas World Aquarium expecting to see oscillated turkeys.
Or expecting to turkey nap any of them, right?
Right, exactly. And so that's where I think most of them, or some of the most notable advancements in captive breeding have taken place.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did hear that they're very expensive. There was a guy in Texas that I did talk to who doesn't have any anymore, but when he had his, he paid $1,500 a piece for them.
Oh, my. I didn't know they were – we might have to get a side business going where we can do a little oscillated turkey breeding.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, Joe, you're going to hate me for saying this, but we are running out of time for this segment. Oh. Mr. McRoberts, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, very interesting. I love it.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I'm glad there's some folks out there interested in oscillated turkeys.
I know I am.
You'll have to let us know when your dissertation is done so we can all read it.
Sure.
Well, I'm on the home stretch, and so I'm looking forward to having that box checked.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah.
Folks, we'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show. Back to Country Joe's Chicken Show, and Joe Barber, Joe himself, is here with us. We were just talking about oscillated turkeys. Now, Joe, I know you have turkeys Do you have poults now, or is it later in the summer that you start them?
No, actually, I just started them the 10th of June. And, of course, these are meat turkeys for Thanksgiving, obviously. And, yeah, my turkeys came in the 10th of June, and we figure 18 weeks, and that's the prime, you know, 18 to 20 weeks is prime time. The turkeys at that time should be around 18 to 20 in the low 20s, you know, 22, 23 pounds for the toms. But, yeah, that's the ideal. And turkeys, they're a little tricky when you first get them. If you've never raised turkeys before, you can lose a lot of them. Because when they get
wet. Why is that?
When they get wet, they just die. And you got to, I had, what was it, a couple of years ago in the incubators, the water tray tipped over on them. And in the incubator, it's like 98 degrees, but they got wet and they develop like pneumonia. And they just die. They're very, for the first month, they're really tricky. Now, the ones that I've just got here, I've got about 100 of them. And they're 6.5 weeks old. And I just barely let them out into the yard, you know, the fenced-in yard. Right. And, you know,
I watched. And how big are they now at 6 weeks? How tall are they?
They're about, if I had to guess, they're something like the size of a pigeon. Right now, something about that size,
but with longer legs.
Yes, but that's the size they are, and they, of course, it's all sand down here, you know, and they just love taking their sand bass and dirt bass, and they're just discovering this whole new thing to discover, and I have the way it's set up, they can go inside and outside anytime they want. So, but I watch them at night. They all go in and they're starting to roost and the whole thing. But that's it. Turkeys are very fascinating to watch. You know, they always got a leader. Everybody's got a leader. You know, and they all follow the leader. And you know. I've been raising turkeys, you know, quite a while now, and it's fun, and that's what got me onto the. I've had different breeds of turkeys, but you know the meat.
Yeah, what breed are you raising now?
These are called the white-breasted, broad-breasted turkeys. These are the ones that get so big that they won't breed on their own. They have to be artificially inseminated, you know, to get them to, you know, and that's how I buy them, as day-old chicks. But they're double-breasted rather than a heritage turkey, which is a single-breasted turkey. So these are the ones that look really, you know, really big.
Those are the ones like the president pardons on national television on Thanksgiving.
Exactly. Yeah, and now if you let those go, within a year, those turkeys will go to way up into the 50-pound range. I mean, they're really, you know, that's why I say we – well, you're supposed to 18 to 20 weeks is the ideal, perfect turkey. It's tender, young turkey, and you get them up to around 20 pounds, and they're perfect. I call them the holiday birds because people buy them for Christmas, New Year's parties, the whole thing. But it's a once a year thing here for me. We get them in about the middle of June, and Thanksgiving week, they're gone.
Except for Lucky the turkey. Is he still still around?
Oh, yeah. She's getting old now. You know, that's a bronze turkey. That was a female. You know, she's getting old now. You can see a little arthritis in her. You know, she walks. It takes her all day to go about 20 feet. But and she doesn't put up with anybody anymore. She hates company.
Well, you know, she's getting to be an old lady, so old ladies, some of them can be a little on the cranky side, and that's understandable.
Yep, she even is with me when I pick her up, put her back in the pen. But she hates the chickens, she hates the other turkeys, she doesn't want to be around anybody, so I got her all alone over there, just how she likes it. And like I say, I let her out in the grass all day, and she picks bugs and... But, you know, I can go over there at night to pick her up to put her back in the pen, and she hasn't gone 15, 20 feet from where she started in the morning.
Now, how old is she now? I know she was pet of the day 2 years ago on Thanksgiving.
Yeah. She's about three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's old for a turkey. Now, I had heard one of those, you know, urban legend type things that the turkeys that people have for Thanksgiving, if they don't get eaten at Thanksgiving, they're not going to live long anyway because they get so big they have heart attacks. Is that just an urban legend thing?
No, they do. They do, because that happens with my meat chickens all the time. Meat chickens are very, very notorious for doing that. A meat chicken, if you got it past 12 weeks, you look at them, they're I've seen them do this, especially in the summer down here. They just turn blue. I mean, blue, sky blue, and they just keel over, you know. It's just the breed of the chicken. They just and they get weak legs and the whole thing. That's why meat chickens are bred today. You know, they're just bred at about 8 weeks, anywhere from 6.5 to 8 weeks. That's the prime time. And I try to hold them over for roasting hens to get them up, and you can, up to about 10 pounds. That's a few extra weeks. But, boy, after that, you know, the mortality rate is just – it's crazy on these birds. And the same thing with turkeys. You know, they just get so big, and that's it. They can't carry – they can't support their own weight anymore. You know, they've got these things bred now where they're just bred for meat, and that's it, you know. That's right. Why a heritage turkey will last a lot longer because, you know, they can breed and they can run. And these turkeys here can't fly, obviously, you know. But, I mean, most of the other turkeys can at least fly a little bit, you know. But these turkeys, they can't – that's it. They're not going anywhere off the ground.
Right, because, you know, they're bred for their meat, so it's no longer important for them to be able to support their weight, or else those turkey wings would be twice as big as what people like on their Thanksgiving bird.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, like I say, I like these turkeys, and there's people around here that have the other rare turkeys, you know, they keep for not for Thanksgiving, but for like pets or ornaments. The royal palm turkey, which is the white one with the black feathers, which is really pretty. You know, there's neighbors that have them. There's a lot of the rarer turkeys down here. There's a guy that got a hold of me that has the black turkeys, and then the slate turkeys, which are – they're all on the critical list. Narragansett turkeys, there's very few of them left. There's somebody down here that was trying to sell me some of those, and it's just a space problem. I don't have the space for them. I like to collect those kind of things, but, you know. But,
and Narragansetts are originally from up here, up in Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a New England early 19th century turkey up there, and but by the 1950s they were almost gone. You know, what I remember about them, I'm trying to look it up real quick here, but I believe by 1997 they did a census on the breeding Narragansett turkeys. There was only 368 of them.
Wow, and that's really low to have a healthy breeding population.
Yeah.
You know, we are running out of time for this segment, and we will be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show, which is sponsored by Grow2Max, that's G-R-O, the number 2-M-A-X.com. And if you enjoy the show, you can always listen to it on iTunes and online at Country Joe's Chicken Show. Back to Country Joe's Chicken Show. Now, we've been talking turkeys, and we were hoping to have Glenn Drown on from the Sandhill Preservation Society. Now, I know that he does a lot of preservation of old breeds. Now, we mentioned that the current breeds that, like, you have for turkeys and some of the meat chickens don't do well beyond a certain age, but the heritage breeds Will, is that one of the reasons why it's good to preserve these breeds?
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot of people that are going back to the heritage breed chickens, the old timers. On my farm here, I just have the egg producers and the meat producers, and I have a small deal, you know, with the rare chickens, the golden campines, and those are my toys, I guess, in the chicken world. and the other kind of rare, well, it is, it's critical, is called a Malay. Remember, I don't know if I've been talking to you about those.
Those are the big tall ones, right?
That's the largest chicken in the world, I guess. The rooster can, or the male can get 3 feet tall. And and I've never seen a live one, and I've been trying to get them. But these, I hear, are very well. I say for a chicken, you know, $300 for a, you know. So I haven't found anybody that has any yet, you know, because they are critical. But they really weird looking chicken. I mean, really, really weird looking. They're
3 foot tall, that'd be taller than your turkeys, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Or yeah. You know, and they don't do well in confinement and the whole deal. And I thought, well, you know, boy, I'd like to try some of those. So, but I haven't, you know, I haven't got them yet, you know, so I don't know. They don't weigh that much. They're just, you know, they're the males are only 9 pounds and, but whatnot, but it's just, they're just a tall, they were bred for fighting. You know, they come from Southeast Asia, you know, and that's what they were bred for. And, you know, so those are the rare type chickens that I like. I love to see those kind of chickens after looking at my Rhode Island Reds and, you know, my other, you know, egg layers every day. You know, it's fun to look at a rare chicken. So those are the things, you know, I'm expanding out here. I'd like to get some of those and, you know, the Egyptian Flamoy, you know, those are another rare one I'd like to get. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just those. But
now, are the Malay good layers, or are they just
very, very bad? They don't lay that well. They don't lay that often, from what I understand. But maybe that's what makes them rare. But
exactly. That could be very well why. Now, yeah. What was the other one you were just about to talk about?
They're called red caps. Yeah, those there, and the Egyptian Flamoys. I'd love to get some of those. Those are all in critical. Most of these chickens are, you know, other than, you know, the standard egg layers, because nobody raises them anymore, and they just go, you know, almost. Well, they have. A lot of them have gone extinct, and that's why I like. You know, like I say, the rarer type birds to try to get up. That's why we get Craig Russell on there, you know, and that's why I belong to that Rare Chicken Society, you know, to get that, you know, to help people get going and see who's got what. And
now, what does the Egyptian Flamoy look like?
It's a little white bird. This one here, from what I was reading about this one, he's been in existence so long that he actually they don't get diseases.
So they're much hardier.
Yeah.
Them, especially, you know, I worry when you say like the turkeys you raise now, they aren't able to breed themselves. They basically are test tube turkeys.
Yeah.
And yeah, so, yeah, that's so. Imagine if it's a hardier bird, you know, adding that into the mix somehow might help. You know, we've got Glenn Drown of the Sandhill Preservation Society that's going to be coming on the show. Our engineer just messaged me that he finally found him. Uh-huh. And I know Glenn is, as I said, of the Sandhill Preservation Society, and they preserve not only chickens, but seeds as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't. I didn't know he did seeds. Wow. So we got him coming on, or is he on now?
We'll have
him finally.
Oh, yay, Glenn. Yay. So glad to have you. I've told everybody where you're from. Welcome back to the Chicken Show.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Glad to have you. Now, I saw on your website you had some problem with some of your turkeys this year.
Yeah, we had major issues last year with buffalo gnats. If you're not familiar with what they are, they're kind of a larger size gnat, and we had billions, and I don't exaggerate when I say billions, and it devastated most of the poultry in this area. Anybody who raised broilers or large commercial type turkeys, it literally took almost entire flocks at points in time. And on our farm, they settled in on our turkeys. We did lose a few chickens, but we lost about 70% of our adult breeder turkeys because the gnats were so thick that they just sucked them dry. They'd get in their ears and suck the blood and cover their whole body, you know, their exposed skin. So it was a challenge, and that brought our numbers down considerably. So
there's nothing you can do to, you know, prevent this or see it coming, anything?
The only thing, we tried everything. The only thing that really works is if you have a smaller facility or a building that you can put a large fan and keep a large continuous volume of air going through. They don't like that. So, unfortunately, with as many breeding pens as we have spread out, we don't have electricity to them because you don't normally think of it being a necessary item to have fans on them. And right. that was kind of a harmful thing for the turkeys. So all of our young stock we kept back in buildings where we could keep a fan on. And still, if you didn't turn that fan on at the right time, the gnats would just swarm wow. the birds in those buildings. I mean, it was something else. We tried all kinds of... This year we had started to get another infestation of them starting, and I was getting calls from local poultry people where they were concerned again, because once you experience that, you don't want to go through it again. And we did Absolutely. Find several products that we could spray on the walls of the buildings and above the birds in the evening times when the gnats were so bad, and that seemed to help. It was kind of iffy for some people, but it worked for some and worked really well for others. The ones that are affected the worst are the people who live near rivers and ponds and things like that, because the gnats just come out of there in swarms.
Now, you talk about having rare turkeys. We were talking earlier in the show about oscillated turkeys. Do you know anything about these or seen any?
I know very little other than I've seen several pictures and have been fascinated by their, you know, that they seem beautiful, but very difficult to find from what I've, you know, over the years from what I've been told. And I've never actually seen a live one, which would be something I would like to see, but I've mm-hmm. not ever had the opportunity. So.
Well, I had a man.
Yeah, our last guest said you might be able to see one if you took a trip to the Dallas World Aquarium.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They have the largest private, flock of them.
And they've been working on domesticating them there. You know, we are running out of time for this segment, and I'm so glad we finally got you. Will you stick on with us for another one?
Yes, I sure will. Sure will. So.
Excellent, folks. We'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show. And we're now talking with Glenn Drown of the Sand Hill Preservation Society. Folks, we'll be right back with more. Country Joe's Chicken Show, and Joe Barber and I are now talking with Glenn Drown from the Sand Hill Preservation Society. Glenn, do you want to give a brief description of what it is for people who have never heard?
Okay. Our operation was started back when I purchased the farm in 1988, when the times for poultry were pretty low in this country. There was massive losses of breeds and varieties, and so it started with that. And also as a joint venture, because I'm also into heirloom seeds. So we maintain a little over 200 breeds and varieties of poultry and about 2,000 different varieties of heirloom seeds we maintain here and produce on this 40-acre farm in east central Iowa.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, and Joe, the good news is I just got permission from our engineer that we can do not only this one, but one more segment. We can do an extra one now that we finally got Glenn with us. Now,
okay.
What are the some of the breeds of poultry that you have that people might not have heard of?
Some of the breeds that we have, you know, if you'd asked that question in 1992, there was a whole bunch. You know, and fortunately, things have been spread around, and we've spread a lot around and got them in other hands. But some of the things that we have, perhaps, that aren't real common that are getting out there now are Cuckoo Scots Dumpies. The Scots Dumpies are the little short-legged birds from Scotland that have that nasty little lethal gene where not all the eggs will hatch because of that short-leggedness. They're a wonderful little calm fowl that is just, they're darling to be around. They're not overly aggressive, but, you know, they look like little, I want to say like little barred rocks with their feet cut off. You know, they're so low to the ground.
Think of Shetland ponies and Shetland sheepdogs, they're all short-legged.
Right. It's that Scottish trait that they select for, I guess. Other birds that we have, or other breeds, we have Erminette chickens, which is we're working on trying to get those back to the status that they were prior to 1900 when they were first. There's color patterns out there that are called Erminette, but if you go on an internet search and you look up Erminette, they'll end up taking you to a picture of like a bad barred rock, which is really not what the Erminette was. And Erminette is a white chicken with black spots in it on the feathering and not, you know, not cuckoo barring or anything like that. So those we rescued last summer from a friend in Wisconsin who had deceased 4 or 5 years ago, had been working with them for years. And when he passed on, this neighbor had taken them on, but just couldn't handle them anymore. So he called and said, "Can you come get these?" And they still need some work in getting some of the roughness out of them from being so long not worked with. But we're doing wonders with them this year and getting them in a few hands of some others that are interested in restoring this breed from the 1800s. So those
and
are our top two,
How do you go about restoring a breed like that?
Well, that is a tough thing. In many cases, you try all kinds of options. The first option you try is to try not to introduce anything that's foreign blood into what you've got. So when I picked these chickens up from Josh, I took pretty much a broadest spectrum that I could get and brought home, you know, 20-some hens and 3 or 4 roosters. And then you just raise all of them you can to try to get a good diversity and not, you know, the tendency to want to cull to get to perfection right away, you have to be careful because you can limit your gene pool on something that's already fairly limited rather quickly, and you can dead-end yourself. So you start out big, and then you start keeping a lot of subgroups and seeing, you know, marking your you know, you put one rooster with a group of hens and another rooster with another group of hens, and there's a lot of toe punching, a lot of tagging and flagging and keeping track of who's related to who, and it takes a lot of time, it can come down to quite a bit of expense because you're feeding a lot of chickens that at the end you don't need that many of, you know, just to get the few to carry on the gene pool. In some rare cases, you sometimes have to try to figure out what was used to create them and to go back and do some crossing to get that new blood and that vigor in there. And then you've got even more work because you've got to do lots of marking and raising and culling. And so you can literally raise, you know, 1,000 chickens to pick just a few that carry the traits that you want. So it takes a little time and quite a bit of effort.
Now, my rare chickens that I like, we were just talking about before you came on, is the Malay, the rooster, the 3-foot-tall rooster.
Oh.
Do you have any of those?
I don't. I've always had a weakness for those and have wanted to get some, but then I always try to exercise a little bit of restraint. That is one that I'm not sure how well they would handle Iowa winters at times, but it is one of those chickens that those Oriental breeds fascinate me with their stature, and in many cases their mannerisms are so, you know, they get a bad rap for being such mean, aggressive chickens, but usually they're very people friendly.
That's what I heard about this. Yeah, and I can't even find any. I've been looking and looking, and I've been in the poultry press. I've been online, everywhere. It's really, really almost impossible to find Malays.
I really, that was one of those, again, that back in when I started this, I would see them at some of the shows that I would go to and didn't think, well, that's a project I can put on hold. But I think you're right. I mean, you know, the time has slipped by, and I have not seen one. Ooh, it's probably been 20 years or better, and I don't know where that gene pool is anymore, if there is a flock out there or a decent flock, you know, that it's one of those things that really needs to be looked out for.
Yeah.
You know, we've had Kermit Blackwood on the show before, who does a lot of work with some of the rare kinds of chickens, and mm-hmm. I'm in a part of a group of his on Facebook. So I'll have to poke Kermit and see if he knows where there are any Malays. Now, Glenn, what is your favorite of the breeds that is now doing really well that you've been able to help preserve?
Oh, wow. That's a toughie. I think the Chanticleers. I like those. Their demeanor is my type of chicken, though I like a diversity in chickens. I shouldn't really say that because I have so many different, you know, I like Fayomis for their wildness and I like this for that, but the Chanticleers, I think, are the ones that I'm most, you know, impressed by, that they're coming along and moving in the right direction, because they were so low in numbers when I started this farm that it just to find any was like finding, you know, a chicken that laid a golden egg, you know, I mean, it was really tough.
And mm-hmm. what constitutes a success in that you don't worry about the breed anymore? How many, you know, flocks do there need to be, or how many birds out there before a chicken is removed from the rare list?
That is a very appropriate question for the day, because this morning I was visiting with the person that's in charge of that at the Livestock Conservancy in North Carolina. She stopped by on her way back from a conference, and we had that discussion this morning for 4 hours as to when do you decide that it's time. And that is that we came to the consensus it's really tough, because, you know, if you look back, we go back to 1992, 93, there was probably two flocks of Partridge Chanticleers in the country. Now there's many more of them, and there's actually some breed clubs working on improving them and getting them, and I think that's great. So, I mean, they've kind of moved off my desperate list to, you know, a little bit better, but in some cases things are sort of artificially look good because they're offered by a number of hatcheries, but when sales drop off, in many cases they're really only being the breeders are only being maintained by one place, and they're being drop shipped to the other hatcheries. So it's kind of an iffy situation. We came to the conclusion this morning that if you're a chicken right now that's not a very large chicken, like the Hamburgs and some of those, and you lay a white egg, you're kind of in a dangerous situation right now, because we're in a very brown egg crazy society. And I'm not saying that's wrong either, but you know, as I look at my flocks of Hamburgs and some of those smaller chickens that lay white eggs, they're in jeopardy at this point in time of getting a lower, you know, genetic diversity and something that we kind of have to be cautious about before we just bail out.
You know, that. I'm going to cut you off there, because we do have one more segment coming up. Joe hates it when I do this, but we're out of time for this segment. Glenn, I'm so glad you'll stick with us. Folks, we'll be right back with more of Country Joe's Chicken Show. to Country Joe's Chicken Show. We have this will be our last segment for the week, but we have this one more, and we're talking rare chickens and preservation of breeds of chickens with Glenn Drown of the Sandhill Preservation Society. And Glenn, do you want to give us your website just in case other people are interested in?
Our website's kind of antiquated. We're going to update it soon, hopefully with some pictures by this time next year, I hope. But it's www.sandhillpreservation.com. We're websites and technology. It's been an interesting change. When we put it together, they said don't put photos on it because people can't do it. And now we need to do that.
Everybody
so
wants
we're
photos.
Oh yeah.
So Joe, I know you had another kind of chicken you wanted to ask Glenn about.
Yes, the red cap. That's my other favorite one that I can't
find. Oh, yes, red caps. Red caps are the story of red caps. We haven't got much time, but I can tell you that I was late high school, early college student in the late 70s. I found a lady where I was living in northern Idaho that had the most magnificent red caps that you could ever imagine. She'd maintained them for like 60, 70 years, and she shared eggs with me. And I had them until I moved to the Midwest, and I've never found a strain as great of looking as hers. Hers were just magnificent. They were big-sized birds like they were supposed to be, and big, huge combs, and just gorgeous. But that has been a project that we've been working on to try to get some size back into them and to keep their vigor and their productivity. And that's one of those challenging projects. But I think they're a gorgeous bird, and I'll probably always maintain them. But I'll always remember fondly the ones that I had at one point in time in my life that were, you know, really what they started out to be.
So you have some now?
Yes, I do. We do have some. Winter was a little bit harsh on them last year, or last winter, but I do have some. They've not laid as well this year, and hatched as well as I would like, but they still have some good vigor and good fairly decent productivity. But they just aren't what I'm hoping for. But I'm kind of a perfectionist, and I'm still striving for what I remember I had at one point in time. So it takes a little more breeding, and it's really hard to get new blood of high quality in the United States. I mean, somehow if you could probably import some from Britain, I'm guessing they would still have some decent ones in the UK somewhere, because that's where they're originally from.
And, you know, in our last segment, you were mentioning worrying about chickens that lay white eggs. Now, our last show we had somebody who did a giant book of bird eggs called The Book of Eggs. And one of the things he mentioned that I asked him was, if you have eggs, you know, old eggs that someone has preserved, can you bring back a species with DNA? Like, you know, we saw it in Jurassic Park in the horror of that. But is that something that anybody is pursuing for some of these rare chickens, if they can find eggs, you know, that were in collections in Chicago and at Cornell? Is that something you could do with the red caps?
I'm not aware of anybody trying that. I'm not saying that it can't happen. That's not an expertise of mine, but I don't know if there's anybody out there working on anything like that. have to get the interest of the right people to pursue a project like that, and most people in most communities don't view the importance of the genetic diversity situation, I think, in many cases. You know, a chicken's a chicken to many people, and those of us who love chickens realize that not all chickens are the same, and, you know, there's that diversity that we all, as Joe was saying earlier, he would love to have some Malays. Well, you know, that's a chicken that very few people obviously want, because there aren't very many of them, but yet they have some unique characteristics and things that we definitely need to make sure we haven't lost.
And the whole egg color thing, I remember when I was a child, which is, you know, a long time ago now, but there was a whole campaign, brown eggs are local eggs, and local eggs are fresh, and apparently everybody believed that.
Yep. Some of those, you still, when we used to sell eggs at the farmer's market, And I would deliberately try to keep my Americana green eggs in one carton and the white eggs in another, and then tinted. I kind of like to sort them by colors. And you would get people who specifically, oh, I don't want those white eggs. Those aren't fresh. You know, and that was, wow. It's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I gathered these all yesterday and washed them all last night. They're all the same age, I guarantee you. Or, you know, then you'd get the opposite, the person who wouldn't want brown eggs because they're too strong. You can't have that strong flavor. You know, they didn't want strong because they were, you know. So,
and
the people
as we
were really
had...
confused are the ones I would mix all the colors in a carton. So. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Isn't that something? Yeah, because that happens to me a few years ago when I used to do the farmer's market here. People, I'd go with the white eggs and the brown eggs, and they'd all come off the same farm here. And I'd come home with white eggs and have no brown eggs. And it was just it's the way
and
people
yet,
are. Yeah.
And yet I remember, you know, 30 years ago when I was a child, we only saw white eggs. I'm in New England. We only saw white eggs around Easter time because we, of course, wanted – we kids wanted the white eggs to be able to color them for Easter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But other than that, all our local eggs were brown.
Yeah, and here's another thing I heard, Glenn. I don't know if this is true or not, that some of the big commercial egg producers that produce brown eggs, they all look so perfectly brown. I heard that they soak them in like a tea to get them all the same tinted – color. Have you ever heard that?
I think you're right, because I was in a grocery store not too long ago, and I looked, opened up a carton just to see what they were looking like, and they just didn't look natural to me.
I know they don't.
I was sitting there I was almost tempted. I should have probably bought the dozen eggs and taken them home and analyzed them, because I was certain that those were not, you know, the color of each egg was exactly the same in the carton,
yes.
And they were not what I considered chicken brown, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes,
you know, I mean, it wasn't the right shade of brown of any breed that I've had or dealt with. So.
I had a man tell me that who worked for a commercial egg. You wouldn't get much detail, but he said they soak them in tea and to get them all, because they want them all the same color brown, because people are fussy like that.
That's very funny. I've never seen a box like that. They must not do that up in New England. We're too suspicious, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I'm thinking, oh God, what else, you know?
When I was a little girl collecting eggs at Aunt Shirley's house, that it was neat to see the variety of, you know, shades and tints.
Yeah. It's my brown eggs are like that. They're spotted, you know, with darker brown spots and then you look at the ones in the supermarket and it's funny. They're all the same color brown, you know. And when I asked about that, that's what they told me. And I said, oh my God, makes sense. You know, somebody figured that out.
Yeah.
Well, we'll all have take pictures and compare them from, because you're in Iowa, is it?
Yeah.
Glenn?
Yes.
You're in Iowa. I'm in Massachusetts.
I'm in Iowa. Yeah.
So we'll have to compare what our eggs look like, our supermarket eggs.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They're all. It's funny when you hear about that and you look, you know, then you know, because it doesn't come to mind, I guess,
right,
unless somebody tells you about it, you know.
Right. Well, we'll all be very vigilant now.
We are in a very uniform conscious society where they want everything to look the same. I mean, you know, if you have.
Yep.
I mean, we're breaking away from that a little bit, but all the tomatoes are the same shape and the same size, you know, and most, you know, so if we keep your eggs all the same shade of brown, it probably has a better marketing appeal.
Well, I guess I'm
gathering them with all the diversity. So.
I guess I'm more of the nonconformist type, but that's why I'm here up near Boston. Well, I want to thank you so much, Glenn. So glad to have you. Joe, we are out of time for this week's show.
And Glenn, it's always fun to have you on here, and we're going to have you on again because it's always interesting. Learn something all the time.
That's right. We'll have to have you talk about seeds sometime because I know that's important too.
Sure.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
But before the engineer just chops us off mid-sentence, I want to thank you for being on with us today. And Joe, will you say it with me?
Okay. May the
flock be with you.